Welcome back, spring term sports dorks. We are here with quite a full desk today. Jack Lazarus, Joe Moore, Joe Krasnowski, Owen Murray, Lily Crane, and Brady Ruth. And we've got a slew of sports to talk about today. A lot of happenings going on in the world of Oregon athletics, and it's been a busy last few weeks for the desk. I mean, everyone's really rolling with their beats, and you know, there's all sorts of stuff that makes every team special. And so we're going to start off with a team that's getting ready for a playoff push here. Owen's been doing a tremendous job with Acro. I mean, just hitting it out of the park. There's been previews, there's been recaps, there's been features, there's been opinion pieces, there's been experience pieces. Owen, what's kind of been the overarching theme of Acro this year? I mean, started the season ranked number 2, but finds itself as a 4 seed in the national tournament. What's kind of been going on?
Yeah, and I mean, even if you look at them, they finished 3-3 on the season, only one top 10 win. It has not been the season they expected. The scheduled Baylor, who, you know, Baylor is the powerhouse in Acro, scheduled them twice, lost both times, once at home, once away. That's not what they wanted. But they are going to roll into the national championships, which is the top 8 team. They're number 4. They got matched up with number 5 against University of Mary Hardin Baylor, not the Baylor Bears, in that first round. That's next Thursday at 1:30 on ESPN+. With kind of a point to prove, I guess. They haven't won a national title since 2014. This is really an opportunity to step it up, because we were talking about this earlier. These Acro meets are spaced out so much. It's like 3-4 weeks between meets. This now, the team that wins the national championship will play 3 meets in 3 days. And that is such
Which is so taxing
difference.
For a sport as physical as Acro.
Absolutely. It's mentally taxing, physically taxing. They're away from home. It's going to be very, very interesting to just see how it goes. I've never watched an Acro national championship before.
And it's a time where you got to be perfect. And yes, perfect has not been what this team is so far. And so how does a team that goes 3-3 with only one top 10 win, how does that team still end up as the 4 seed? What's been kind of the silver lining to keep them relevant, to still be able to be technically the favored team in the playoffs?
You know, part of it is that this is Oregon Acro. This is one of the historically great programs, so it's really tough to leave them out. Strength of schedule absolutely factors into it. I mentioned number 1 Baylor twice, number 2 Quinnipiac once. They lost all 3 of those. Beat number 6 Azusa Pacific on the last day, but they've been pretty solid in that number 4 spot, which shows that the NCAA, which is NCAA of Acro, is pretty content keeping them in that spot. And they haven't lost meets by a lot. Right. Usually they'll roll into that last event, which is worth almost a third of the points in the meet. They're only trailing by, you know, 1 or 2 points, or maybe even leading, and then that's where they tend to fall away. So that's what they're going to have to fix if they go to the national championship, really nail down that team routine.
So it sounds like that ranking then of just Oregon being a historically dominant program, it sounds kind of like why Notre Dame is ranked to start every football season is just because it's Notre Dame. But what are some of those events that you said Oregon goes into the last event kind of trailing only by a couple points, but why is Oregon trailing by a couple points? What's been kind of the main event or two where the Ducks have been kind of consistently falling short, or have you seen improvement in those certain events as the season's gone on?
The interesting thing is that it almost doesn't matter if you're pretty average across the season in all of the first 5 events. The way they do it is they kind of split all the skills that you're going to use in that last event into 5 separate events. There's just building blocks, I think is how I've heard it described, for a safe progression, really, because you go into this team event, it's just 2 minutes and 45 seconds of just absolute chaos. And so you can get away with maybe a fall in the early rounds because those events are worth 30 points max. The team event's worth 100-ish. So really, if you feel confident in your team event, you can afford maybe a slip or a little mistake there, but the team event is where you cannot make mistakes. A slip there is really going to cost you.
And it has cost them, and now it sounds like they've got a really tough bracket. I mean, where you got to play the 5 seed, and then assuming that everything goes to plan, you're playing Baylor in the second round.
Yeah, it is a really difficult, and it's why Coach Taylor Cisneros told me at the start of the time, they're really focused on staying in that two seed spot, and it's really unfortunate that they weren't able to do that because it's going to be a tough road.
What was it like being able to see Baylor come to town? Like, to see a team that's been number one all year and proven why it should be number one all year. What was it like, just as a student journalist, as an Akro fan, to see the Baylor Bears come to town?
They're just, it's really on a different level. Because you watch these, and what Baylor does really well, to be honest, is develop people. They've got two freshmen on there who are both, they both run solo passes for the Bears, which is like, that means like they're the best tumblers on the team. And to be there as a freshman, these are people who haven't done Akro before at all. Very few of the people in college Akro have competed that exact sport before in their lives. And to have those guys come in and develop, they've got a great coaching structure. Their coach, Felicia Mulkey, was Oregon's coach for the four national titles that the Ducks won here. It was impressive. They're on a different level, man. I find it very hard to see anybody else winning.
And for Oregon to do so, going to have to completely revamp how it's playing.
Absolutely.
We're going to have to get a hot over the next few weeks after what was kind of a lackluster regular season. Now over to the guy that likes to use the word lackluster more than anyone I've ever met in my life. Jack, what's been going on with golf? It sounds like it's been a fairly lackluster season, yet every time that we're looking at your pieces, it still says that the Ducks, both men's golf and women's golf, are ranked. How's that happening?
So I would say that a lot of that has to do with strength of schedule. A lot of their meets include at least, I would say, five teams in the top 25. And a lot of those teams at the same time are in the Pac-12. The Pac-12 and the West Coast in general, with teams like Pepperdine, UC Davis, San Jose State, they're all really good golf teams. Like, for example, Oregon's finishing their regular season right now at the Western Intercollegiate. It's hosted by San Jose State. And the top four teams are Arizona, Stanford, Washington, Oregon right now. Those are all Pac-12 teams. And I think that there's no way for Oregon to kind of avoid being grouped with those teams in these big tournaments. And then when they don't, you know, when they don't really deliver and they don't play at their best, it's really hard to really climb the leaderboard.
It's sounding like, though, with on both the men's and women's team, I mean, obviously Romero's a star, but outside of that, it sounds like it's kind of been who's going to be hot on any given day, who's going to be hot on any given weekend. Do you see that as a strength of this team, that anyone could get hot? Or is that like a, man, this team's lacking, these teams are lacking leadership potentially?
Well, on the women's team, it is a positive because of how good Romero is and how good she's always going to be. I don't think that's ever really going to change. So the anyone can get hot mentality kind of just it reflects on everyone else, and usually someone else, you know, finds their rhythm. But on the men's team, it's more of a negative because that star or like those two stars were supposed to be the two fifth-year seniors, Nate Stember and Owen Averett. However, they have kind of fallen off a little bit. I think they kind of have a similar issue. Not similar play styles. Averett, his problem is that for every birdie he has, he's got a double bogey in him. So he really like is always up there in terms of total birdies in a tournament, especially in relation to his teammates. But he's never able to avoid mistakes. And I think the opposite is the case for Stember. Stember is usually top in pars. So he's always going to make it. Like today, for example, he hasn't shot a bogey yet. He's through nine holes and, you know, three birdies and an eagle.
Wow.
Up until today, Oregon had one eagle in the tournament. And I think Stember, for the first time this season, is really just taking the reins of the team and finding his rhythm.
How many career eagles do you have?
Career eagles?
Career eagles.
If I had a career eagle, I'd be playing college golf.
I think I can count my number of birdies on one hand.
Yeah.
Lifetime.
Me too, man.
It's interesting to follow these collegiate golf tournaments and be like, this person's two over. They suck. And I'm like, if I'm two over after two holes, I'm pumped.
Yeah, my dad texted me after my first piece that he had read, and he was like, you pay so much money to be two over right now. And I was like, I know.
I think we should start taking prop bets because you and I, Jack and I, going to Ireland this summer to do a sports reporting, sports feature writing class in Dublin. Obviously going to be playing some courses out there.
Take the over.
Take the over?
Take the over, yeah.
Yeah, and the links courses are not too friendly to me, so.
The golf courses are not are not too friendly to me. So you said men are wrapping up their final regular season meet. What are the women looking forward to?
They wrapped up their regular season last week. They're pretty good. Like, they have, they're set up nicely to at least get top five, but I think in relation to other Pac-12 teams, they have the ability to find that edge and really just convert birdie opportunities. Because what I've seen from the team is they get close to the hole within enough shots, but the opportunities are wasted on the short game. Mm. And that's not a problem for someone like Romero, but, you know, Minori Nagano, who's the second highest ranked player on the team, even though she's in the 60s, she's, you know, fairly highly ranked. She never really finds the edge when she's close in on the pole. So I think that for Oregon to really take that next step, they need to cut out a little bit of mistakes, but more on the side of converting birdies.
Sounds like they know what to do. They just got to find a way to do it now as we kind of get into postseason play. But going from postseason play to preseason play, Oregon spring football is underway, getting ready for the spring game coming up here next week. And what's something that you're looking forward to within this spring season or within this just new football era in general?
So, I mean, while we have so many transfers coming in and so many things that are changing from last year, The main crux of the team is what's staying. And one of the main pieces that's staying, while he may be, you know, underrated and stuff, is actually Oregon's long snapper. He's gone into his redshirt junior season. Luke Basso, he's an amazing long snapper. He was the third-ranked long snapper coming out of his high school class. And he's an underrated key part of this team. He's most likely going to be a special teams captain next season. And, you know, I don't think I've seen him make a mistake once going into last season, and then I watched him pretty closely this season, and nothing really happened. He started all 14 games. He had 10 snaps in three of those games, and I think next season is just more improvement, and I think Luke can really take this to the next level.
And long snapper's cool because it's one of those positions where, like, the less you hear about it, the better.
Exactly.
like I don't want to hear about I don't even want to know who the Oregon long snapper is, because if I know who it is, it means that the punt team's on the field too much. It's the same thing with, like, defensive backs. Like, I never want to hear about a defensive back's day, because if I hear about it, he's either got three interceptions or he's probably gotten torched.
Yep.
So I'm excited to see that this underappreciated position kind of come to light. That'll be good to look at.
Yeah, speaking of the new additions, I mean, with the new coming season, it's tough not to look at the quarterback battle.
Of course.
Dante Moore and Dylan Gabriel. You have to assume that Dylan Gabriel is going to get the start going in, but having a backup of the quality of Dante Moore, having a backup of that quality who's a sophomore, that's a really good sign for Oregon football going forward, especially with Dylan Gabriel being here for just 1 year.
Were you surprised to see the Dante Moore transfer? I mean, for those that don't know, Dante Moore was originally committed to Oregon, decommitted, went to UCLA, spent a season with the Bruins where he was okay at best, and now transfers to Oregon. And a lot of the reasons why people thought that maybe he transferred to UCLA is so that he didn't have to try to compete with Bo, and now Dylan Gabriel, but he's going to have to compete with Gabriel, or is he, or is there this assumption of the team's going to be yours, but you got to develop for a year? Like, where do you see that relationship being?
Yeah, I was shocked to see him transfer back over here, especially because, if I'm remembering correctly, his transfer came after Dylan Gabriel's.
Yeah.
Right. So seeing him transfer or decommit from Oregon, commit to UCLA, mostly the thought was because of Nick's, like you said. It was weird to me to see him come back to be a backup, but I think that he is operating under the assumption that, like you said, it's going to be the team is yours. You just got to wait a year. And if that's where he's at. If he just wants to sit back, like work on his game himself for a year and then take over, I think that could be really good for his development, and I think that could be really good for Oregon football.
Well, and we're in an era of college football now where all it takes is one good year to turn yourself into a draft guy. I mean, we kind of saw that with Christian Gonzalez. I mean, I grew up, like, before I came out here, watched him at Colorado. He was, his first year, he was a defensive liability. I mean, every ball in the air was a touchdown or a pass interference call. And then he comes out here and he has the great, just incredible year with the Ducks, and he ends up getting drafted in the first round. Like, we're, all we need now is one good year. So I'm not against the idea of, you know what, yeah, I'll sit back and I'll learn a system to make sure that I'm ready to be the number one guy next year. And that way when I am, bang, now I'm ready. Now I just need this one year. It's my go prove it year. I was bummed that we never got to see that from Ty Thompson. I feel for the kid. I'm excited because we get three straight years of Bo Gabriel. Like, that's exciting. But man, you got to feel for Ty Thompson a little bit. But a lot of feelings lately with Oregon sports. Sure, some joy I'm sure you felt in Vegas watching the Oregon men's team win the Pac-12 championship. What was it like getting to be there for that weekend or for that week, getting to take in the last Pac-12 men's basketball tournament and seeing the four-seeded Ducks find a way to win it?
It was incredible. I mean, very bittersweet. You know, the Ducks played UCLA in the first round. They're coming with Oregon to the Big Ten, but Arizona, Colorado, the other two teams the Ducks played in Vegas, they're both heading to the Big 12. So it's a bittersweet kind of, like, this is the last Pac-12 championship. Ducks go out on top. Ducks are going to be the reigning Pac-12 basketball champions for
forever.
Who knows how long? Maybe forever. But yeah, I mean, just the experience as a whole was incredible. Seeing, like, at the end of it all, like, the green and yellow confetti cover the court was an amazing experience.
And it, I'm sure it was. And I thought it was interesting that they had the green and yellow confetti, because how many teams did they have confetti on hand for? Like, did they have all 12 school colors? Like, I kind of find that hard to believe. Did they wait to get confetti until you were in the Final Four, and then you get your Final Four teams? Like, do you only have confetti for the top four teams, and then you have just, like, generic gold for everyone else? Or were the Ducks just the script, and they bought green and yellow confetti?
Honestly, after watching this team all year, the way they put it together in the Pac-12 tournament, and then it looked great in March Madness for a couple games, it may have been the script. That team had an incredible turnaround right at the end of the year, from losing their second-to-last game of the season against Colorado the way they did to just dominating the Pac-12 tournament. It was an incredible turnaround.
I'm sure it was. Yeah, it completely was. I'm sure it was incredible to be there. It was a bummer to see how the season ended, though. As obviously, took Creighton to double overtime. It was a good game, but people not named Enfali Dante and Jermaine Cousinard had 2 points from the second half on in that Creighton game. It was a bummer to see this Cinderella story turn back into the pumpkin there in that late in that second half, and just no offensive production. Like, I wish that they would have just gotten beat by Creighton. Like, in regulation, you'd be like, man, like, they fought really hard and they went out on a high note, instead of kind of watching it all crumble apart there late. But regardless, an incredible ending of a season that had been pretty lackluster through the first 5-6 months of it. So a really cool ending, really cool opportunity. It was awesome to see the coverage that came from you. We got a ton of exposure from it. It was really cool to have someone out there for it. But now you've been able to change gears pretty quickly, and you and Kraz and Lily, like, there's been a lot of softball conversation, a lot of softball coverage going on. What have we kind of seen so far from the Ducks? Started the year ranked, then suddenly we're unranked, but then we're back, and been looking okay in Pac-12 play, but it's kind of looked, from the outside at least, like it's been just kind of series by series. What have you guys seen?
I think it's very series by series. I mean, they were so successful. Big win against Washington, the first time beating Washington under the Melissa Lombardi era. Go out to Arizona and play Grand Canyon. They lose the series to Arizona. So it's kind of taken, it's hard to find that consistency with this team that's preached consistency so much, that's preached that veteran leadership, And down the stretch, I mean, we'll see if they can get hot in Pac-12 tournament. I mean, that's what they'll need to do. Doesn't look like it's very serious a series with this team, as they've struggled to both. They're very average in a way, I'd say. There's nothing that really catches the eye at the moment.
And part of that too is the strength of the Pac-12 this year as a conference. I mean, Oregon has 3 series wins, 2 series losses so far in conference play, but those are against 4 ranked teams. Well, at the time, Cal has fallen back a little bit, but at the time, Cal was ranked in the top 25. The only team that Oregon has played in the Pac-12 that hasn't been ranked is Arizona State, and they swept them. So getting a series win over number 9 Washington, losing a series against number 21 Arizona back-to-back, it's tough for this team to really find that consistency when they're playing the best of the best week after week.
And what have you seen being the main issue? Is it that pitching isn't there? Is it that offense isn't there? Or is it like the series, it's week to week? Some days the pitching shows up, sometimes the offense isn't there. What's been the main observation from where they're lacking?
The offense it's very hit or miss. They'll have games against...
I get it.
They'll have games against top opponents where they get 10-plus hits. They look incredible, but they'll also have games where they get, like, 5 or 6 hits, and they score 1 or 2 runs, and it's just... They've had a couple losses this year. They had one against Arizona over the weekend where it was 3-2, and it was just the offense couldn't get going, but the pitching was really good for that whole game. And it's just if they got more than 5 hits or 6 hits or whatever they got in that game, it's a different story, but they just couldn't get there.
I think the Achilles heel for Oregon softball kind of these past couple of seasons has been being able to drive in runners that are in scoring position. Usually, I mean, there's games here and there where, you know, can't get too many hits recorded. But for the most part, I mean, their leadoff hit, like the first few hitters in the order are pretty solid getting on base. But yeah, when they have those fluky games that they drop in the series, tends to be because they aren't able to drive home their runners.
And you have to wonder how much they're going to be able to do going down the stretch without Hannah Delgado. I mean, yeah. down in Arizona, had a scary collision with the wall. Sounds like physically she's going to make a complete recovery, but you'd have to imagine that she's going to be a non-factor for the Ducks for at least the foreseeable future.
No, it's going to be difficult. You're talking about driving in runners. She was at the 9 spot. She'd been so clutch in getting on base for the middle of the order. It's the lineup, it's very top-heavy at the moment, especially with Delgado's absence, and being able to drive in runners, it's something hard to do when you don't have that spark plug at the end of the lineup.
And just her versatility, too. Head coach Melissa Lombardi has talked a lot about her, Delgado's ability to just slot into any spot in the lineup. And so she's been playing the 9 a lot, but she also let off a game or two, and she played in the 2 spot a couple times. So missing that ability to just kind of put her wherever and, like, trust her to get on base, it's going to be tough for the Oregon offense.
It definitely is. It's a good team. It's not a great team. The Ducks should make the national tournament, and maybe they can get hot again like they did last year, sneak into a regional. But in general, the Diamond Sports, at least as far as softball goes, maybe not where we thought it would be, but still opportunity to get there. I want to shift gears a little bit back to basketball. We talked about how exciting the ending of the men's season was. The ending of Oregon women's season was pretty disappointing. I mean, just a lot of continuous losses to ranked teams, but just not a good women's basketball team this year. And now you got Chance Gray transferring out to Ohio State. You got Grace Van Sluten going to Michigan State, both Big Ten conference rivals next year. But so not great for Oregon women's basketball, but it's been a very awesome last couple of weeks, last month for women's basketball as a sport. I mean, the WNBA draft was incredible. It was really cool to see the women's national championship game get more viewers than the men's national championship game. But Lily, you got to go up to Portland and watch some of these high caliber women's teams. What was that experience like?
Yeah, and me and Joe Moore were both at the Portland Regionals in at the Moda Center. I think it was Portland Regional 3 and Portland Regional 4, and got to see some of those Sweet 16 Elite 8 matchups. And it was a really cool experience. A little overwhelming as a student journalist at first, navigating, you know, setups a little different for each event at the Moda Center, and so many media members there, a lot of coverage, and then just big name figures in women's basketball at the press conferences. But it was great crowd numbers. Have a piece coming out soon. Hopefully by the time the podcast's out, my pieces will be out as well about the Portland regionals and some of those numbers we saw. But at the same time, there's, you know, some snafus as well. The first three games of the weekend, a big storyline was the three-point lines that the manufacturer of the court got it wrong, and they didn't realize it till day three.
But only on one side of the court. Right?
It was on one side, but they like showed the percentages that the numbers weren't as good.
Right, but like
that's
the part that baffles me. Mm-hmm. Is it's not like you got the court wrong. You only got one half of the court wrong. So your measurements were half right? Like it's just bizarre.
Yeah, going back for the final game when they had fixed it, the game with USC versus UConn, they had moved the 3-point line back, but they hadn't changed the color inside the arc. So you could see exactly where...
They just painted over it.
They just painted a new line. So you could see exactly where was considered a three-pointer before they changed the line. And it was just... It was a mess.
Not great. Not great. But what a great opportunity it was this year, too. I mean, we were able to cover a women's basketball team that obviously had its issues. But to be able to cover the Pac-12 and we are going to beat this storyline into the ground. This covering the last season of Pac-12, but for on the women's basketball side, it was an incredible year for the Pac-12. There were so many incredibly talented ranked teams: UCLA, USC, Stanford, Colorado, Oregon State was very good. Like, what a season it was for that! And to get to watch those high caliber teams and those high caliber players come through Matthew Knight Arena to beat the brakes off of Oregon was pretty cool to watch.
It was awesome.
Honestly. And I mean, to be able to sit there and watch the WNBA draft last night and be like, oh yeah, Cameron Brink, saw her play. Like
it's pretty remarkable. Oh,
like Juju Watkins will be saying the same thing about her in a few years. And I mean, she's going to the Big Ten. We'll see more of her. But what a cool season it was for Pac-12 women's basketball. And then with the tournament being as big of a success as it was, the national tournament, everyone was watching it, everyone was talking about it, everyone was talking about Caitlin Clark in Iowa, Angel Reese in LSU, Paige Beckers in UConn. Like, there were so many storylines. It was a really, really cool year for women's basketball. And it's really cool that you both got to be up there and experience that excitement about a sport that's deserved excitement for a long time now. So, Lily, we'll switch back to football. I want to ask you, what are you looking forward to in spring football, in the spring game? Do you enjoy the spring game? Is it just a glorified scrimmage?
I mean, I think the spring game is always interesting to see some of the new players that are transferring in and some of the freshmen that have arrived early and to get a look on them. I mean, talked about Dante Moore and Dylan Gabriel. I think that's the big headline to me, is seeing the new quarterbacks. And it's not just one, it's two, like, pretty high-profile quarterbacks that we get to see in the spring game. So excited to see that, and working on a piece on all the new coaching changes, because Dan Lanning staying in Eugene, big storyline, but a lot of names moving in and out of the coaching staff.
Absolutely. I got one of the damn green hats for Easter, and I'm actually wearing it right now. It was one of those things where, like, I really wanted to get behind Lanning in this team, but I was like, I was scared that Oregon was still a stepping stone. But then after he posted that damn green, the grass is damn green in Eugene video, I was like, all right, I was already behind it, but I was like, all right, I can financially get behind
it.
One part of the spring game no one's brought up yet, which is just absolutely ridiculous, is the concert afterwards. I mean, come on, Matt Kearney playing Coming Home and all those other Matt Kearney songs.
Brady Hates Fun.
I mean, good for Matt Kearney, good for Oregon. I don't think, can anyone in this room name a Matt Kearney song that's not Coming Home?
There's a lot of other ones, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure there is, but I'm not a spring game fan.
Glorified scrimmage.
It is. It's a cool environment because the student body gets to come together and do the walk to Autzen. And when it's a sunny day, there's jugs of,
one might say,
fruit punch.
The stumble
all
to Autzen.
Over the place. Yeah, the student body stumble to Autzen. But the actual quality of play on the field, it's cool to be there for the first quarter or so, and then quickly slips away. But right next to Autzen Stadium, there's been a women's lacrosse team that's been playing this year that got off to a hot start, and then like some of these other teams got into conference play, kind of hit a wall. Joe, you've been covering with us. Lily, you've been doing KWVA for women's lacrosse. What are we seeing from this team so far?
They just can't compete with some. It's a little bit of an interesting contrast because there's some teams that they just can't compete with. They lost 19-9 against USC and scored once in the second half. But then again, this past week against San Diego State, that really lackluster performance. San Diego State came in with one win on the season. And
lackluster?
One might say lackluster.
Lackluster.
Subpar.
Jack Lazluster. Nope.
Nope.
Cut that out.
Cut that.
Lackluster. How are my Lady Buffs doing?
Oregon is going to play them in their final game of the season. And the Buffs are pretty good. They're ranked in the top 25. So Lady Buffs are holding it down. They're doing pretty solid. Looks like Oregon's going to need to win their final two games against Arizona State and Colorado, which honestly seems unlikely to be able to make the Pac-12 tournament. But
yeah, and I'll add that for lacrosse, since not every Pac-12 team has a lacrosse team, they added a couple of other schools this season, San Diego State and UC Davis also joining Pac-12 lacrosse. And so not every single team makes the Pac-12 tournament. I think there will be six teams in the tournament.
Which I like. I like a tournament that every team's not in it. Like, as cool as it is.
It adds some drama down the stretch.
Oh, maybe there'll be the 12 seed that gets high. Like, I like the, now you got to earn it. You got to make your way there. Baseball at the end of the year is the same way. They take 9 of the 11. It's a weird baseball format. I don't like the format at all. But I like that it's 9. It's not the whole, it's bizarre. But I like that it's like, you got to earn your spot to the conference tournament. And it sounds like women's lacrosse maybe not going to be able to do that. But, Joe, through reading your pieces, there's been two or three girls playing in net for Oregon this year. Is that it kind of been a revolving door as they try to figure out who the one is? Or is it just like there's just a lack of goaltending talent on this roster?
A little bit of both. Thayer Hubbard got most of the starts earlier on in the season, and Cassidy Eckert got the start against San Diego State, where she ended up losing. It's kind of just a rotating door of just seeing who's playing, who's healthy maybe. It's really interesting to see, but honestly, the results have been kind of the same. The team's just not unbelievable, and the teams are playing are normally pretty solid. San Diego State one was a weird because Oregon got off to this hot start and then just kind of fell asleep almost in a way and just didn't play well down the stretch and ended up losing, a big upset. That really surprised me, especially because they'd played so well against these bad teams earlier on in the season. I figured they'd be able to take care of business against San Diego State, but they weren't able to.
Yeah, you seemed really, really high on this team.
I was.
And then they took that road trip, played Rutgers, and then started playing.
Yeah, I feel like Merrimack, you know.
I hesitate to say real schools, but they started to play some real schools, and the record showed it. What are you looking forward to with your first spring game out here in Eugene?
I'm looking forward to going to PK Park for the Emeralds game after.
Ah,
but eyes on the prize.
Yeah, big bummer there. Spring weekend, it feels like, is always a weekend where Oregon baseball is also home, and it's cool to see fans flock from Autzen over to PK, and that'll be great for the Emeralds. But Oregon, Oregon baseball is playing at Oregon State that weekend. That's a big missed opportunity.
Yeah, but I'm excited to be able to enjoy Autzen Stadium one time as a fan, cover a lot of games. So it'll be cool to be able to go as a fan, go with some friends. And then for my story for that game, I'm focusing on the offensive line. Obviously, losing JPJ was probably going to be in a first, second rounder. It'll be cool to just be able to see how they're going to be able to regroup and focusing mainly on Marcus Harper the second. And he had told me a really cool story about his old coach in high school where Marcus didn't even play. He hadn't even played football up until high school and got into it with a little bit of wrestling. And then he's now starting his senior season off with Oregon, so it'll be cool to see how that works out.
Switching back over to PK Park, we mentioned Emeralds, we mentioned Ducks. Oregon baseball ranked 18 right now, but man, I just don't buy it. This team is not as good as its record shows. Now, the Ducks haven't lost a Pac-12 series yet, which is saying something. But the way that the Ducks are winning games is just not sustainable right now. And it's interesting because it's like we talked about with lacrosse. It's the talent of the Pac-12 really hurting Oregon. You look at Oregon's offensive stats overall, and the Ducks are second, third in the conference in most offensive categories. Then you sort that into conference games. Oregon's at the bottom in nearly every offensive category, barely hitting over the Mendoza line in conference games right now. Just not good enough, not sustainable. But maybe they can turn it. I mean, they're winning games, and like head coach Mark Wasikowski said after taking 2 out of 3 from USC, good, not great. You know, we're winning conference series, and that's not something that you can complain about. But at the same time, it feels like there's another level that Oregon baseball can reach that it just isn't yet. But Owen, you were with me for 2 games this weekend. What was the main takeaway that you took from baseball?
Well, I sat with you for 6 hours in my first ever baseball game.
That was
in college.
Long.
It's always like that.
Is it now? Yeah. I felt at home because it was raining all the time, man. But really what I took away, and I wrote a column on this, is that college baseball is what was it, desperately in need of a pickoff rule.
Yeah.
Because my goodness, the first at bat I watched Grayson Grenzell try to pick off Austin Overton at first base like 7 times in the first inning. He got him once, and then they kept trying for the rest of the game. Nobody kept doing it. There were 30, 40 attempts. It slows it down so much.
Yeah, there's two rules that college baseball needs to bring in that Major League Baseball already has, and that's the pickoff rule. And Major League Baseball, you get 2 pickoffs per plate appearance. If you try to pick off a third time and you don't get the runner, it goes as a balk. He automatically takes second. The other one, you need 3 batter minimum. You can't keep having this, like, pitcher comes in, faces a guy, all right, we're going to go to the next guy. Like, and that one isn't as much of a problem as the pickoff rule, but pickoffs, I agree, they've got to be changed. But from a Ducks team that has a good record and a good ranking but maybe isn't playing the best brand of baseball to a team that's also here in Eugene that Jack and Joe have both been able to cover, what are the Eugene Emeralds up to besides hunting for a stadium?
Well, in a way, they're kind of like Oregon lacrosse, if you think about it, because the teams they have played are not so good. But they are 8-1, so it doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, a win is a win. Not a ton of top prospects on the team, but they've been able to put wins together, and it'll be interesting to see how it ends up shaping up. Bats are always a little bit behind arms to start off the season. Once the weather gets warmer, the offense tends to pick up. So we'll see if that happens again. It's been fun to see early on.
Yeah. I mean, the main takeaway, like Joe just said, is, you know, bats are ahead of arms. I would say that the Eugene bullpen is actually very successful. I mean, one thing I've noticed is my tweets about Nick Sinicola get attention from, it looks like, the Blue Jays. So one thing to look out for is Nick Sinicola could be on the move, could be moving up and down. I mean, the first game that he had, he was pretty perfect outing. I probably a hit or two, but I think he went for 2 innings and had 3 or so strikeouts. And then and then throughout the rest of the season, he's been put in a few more times, and he's not really like reached that level. But from the attention, you know, the only attention I've gotten from some of my tweets have been from Nick Sinicola, and given his actual pretty good play, just not out there as better than everyone, which is something you kind of need in single A if you're going to make the move to double or triple A.
Yeah, Dylan coming on the mound tonight, and he's been really good to start off the season too. So they got some good arms. That's, you know, a little subpar to start, but
so. Eugene Emerald, it's fun, man.
They do a good job.
Those games are fun.
Yeah. And shout out the marketing team.
It was a bummer to see the roster at the start of the year because there isn't, you know, a Marco Luciano. There's not a Grant McRae. There's not one of these, like, top 5 prospects. But I don't care who's playing. Take me to a baseball game and I'm happy. like that's really what it comes down to. But I want to finish off the podcast. First, I want to hear from Owen. Owen, what's your takeaway going to be from the spring game? And then I got a fun, like, debate question to close us out here.
Ooh. Yeah, the
oh, you already know it. Oh, you know it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm for the spring game, I'm going to cover it, hopefully, and we're going to talk a little bit about this wide receiver core that's coming in.
Yep.
Which is, you know, debatably the number one wide receiver core in the nation, which is really exciting. Anytime you get to see that level of play up there, Evan Stewart, obviously coming in this year, going to take a look at him, see what he looks like. But also got quite the core coming back. You know, return everybody except for Troy Franklin, so it's going to be interesting to take a look at.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun team next year, and there's a lot of excitement about the Ducks in the running for Big Ten championships early, if you can count off-season championships. I don't know, some people like to. But we're going to close it out. When you go to the spring game, it's always like green versus yellow. Which team do you pull for? But more importantly, this was something that Owen and I were debating during this three-hour rain delay. When you picture the Oregon O logo, what color is it?
Oh, it's yellow. Middle of Autzen Stadium. It's big yellow O.
Chris says yellow.
I was going to say yellow, and I was actually going to mention PK Park for that one.
Okay, yellow.
It's yellow. You know the track down sign? We're green and yellow.
Okay. All right. I'll be on the other side of this. I think it's
going
to
be on the wrong side.
When I picture the Oregon logo, I think of like the helmet that the football team was wearing when I first started paying attention to the Ducks, and it was a white helmet with a green O on it. And there's O signs over like Unthink, and okay. I don't know. And I just think of like Oregon. I think of green. So when I think of that logo, I think green. Joe Moore.
I think of yellow.
Yellow, Lily.
But the O at Matt Knight is green.
Yellow, right. That's another good example. Ooh, the, Matt Knight is green.
From the editor?
Asher says yellow. I'll be in the minority here, and that's
Matt,
fine.
The trees at Matt Knight, really, that's what takes my attention rather than the O.
Yeah.
The O is...
For me, it's Brendan Rigsby. Long gone now.
The O is green. But it's like sometimes when you look at the standings, like when you go on certain apps and stuff and you look at standings, it'll have a green O. Sometimes it'll be a yellow O. Maybe this is only a debate in my mind because I'm the only one here that's going to fight green, but I don't know.
It was pretty 50-50 on Twitter, right?
It was legitimately 50-50. There were 16 votes for each side, but I don't know. I'll stick with it green, and I'll fight this until our next episode comes out. We'll meet up again in a couple weeks to recap spring game, talk about what we saw from it, and continue to talk about how some of these Oregon athletic teams that are going into the playoffs are doing, as well as kind of baseball and softball as they push towards postseason play.